Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics. I am one of your hosts, Margot Poupard.
And I'm your other host, Emily Beijin.
It's times of crisis like this when we need mindless reality TV more than ever. I mean, who's trying to rewatch The Irishman right now? Liars, that's who. So yeah. Vanderpump Rules can get me through the 2016 election, I believe that revisiting VH1's pop culture pantheon of classic celeb reality TVs will get us through this COVID.
This is my pledge agree. To you.
In this essay, I will. Before we get into our topic of the day, a quick little vibe check because we can't go on without it. How are you doing since I talked to you on Saturday?
Holy shit, Margot. I couldn't agree with you more that all I need right now is trashy celeb reality, where in an alternate universe once upon a time, we actually thought that there were 20 women every year who would want to vibe for Flavor Flav's Love and Affection.
I wish for those simpler times, but you'll be happy to know that I started to watch the Tiger King show on Netflix.
Oh,
so I am properly hooked. I needed something else, you know. I am going to watch Cats this weekend. I'd been saving that. I didn't want to, you know, you can't just like blow your self-isolation
the
very first week. I've been like dispensing like little bits of like podcasts and TV and all this and just like starting little projects that I may or may not finish. Depends how much time we're stuck in here. But yeah, so I started The Tiger King because I needed like a dose of insanity. And Vanderpump Rules has gotten dark, honestly, a little bit.
Oh,
and so has like some of my other Bravo staples. And, you know, New York doesn't come back for another week at this point. So I needed something. I needed a little crazy. And okay, so I'm just going to say, like, I understand that, like, cat people, okay, yes, they're weird. But, like, big cat people are fucking weird.
No, for sure.
They're all very, very weird. And so for any of them to think
– yeah.
I'm only on episode two. No plot twists. The thing that I just think that it's hilarious that they think that one person could be better than the other one when they're all just terrible.
Oh, for sure. They're all terrible. It only gets worse. And what I love, not a plot twist, but a twist, is when we start out in Oklahoma and we start out in Myrtle Beach and you think, oh, gee, this screams of Florida, but we haven't seen anyone in Florida yet. And then lo and behold, later we're introduced to this woman who, in fact, lives in Florida. And then you're like, oh, there it is. There it is. I cannot wait for you to finish this.
Florida,
it is bonkers.
Will always come into play. I can't wait. I'm so excited. I think that they're all insane. It, like,
oh,
the whole thing gives me anxiety. I don't even know, but it's great.
Compass.
I love being.
I've never seen compass more like fucked up in my entire life.
Okay, I promise that we're going to get to the VH1 stuff, but really quick, that doc guy 100% looks like a Philip Seymour Hoffman character that he would come up with.
Oh, for sure.
I don't know.
If the late Philip Seymour Hoffman were still with us, he would have been the movie that will inevitably come out. For sure.
I think there will be a movie. They already announced something that's going to be – it's going to be Kate McKinnon is starring as Carol.
Oh, thank God.
And if, you know, R.I.P. P.S. Hoffman was still around, he would definitely be playing that doc guy. I mean, honestly.
So as you can tell from our impassioned plea to watch The Tiger King, you can tell that we are starved for some mindless entertainment. When VH1 first started to do celeb reality, did you immediately start watching? I know that I got hooked with celeb reality for some reason. I'm not sure if it was like some transition from like music videos into TV shows, but it felt really seamless and it really did just spiral. But go ahead.
Totally. And here's what I think, my theory. And I came up with this theory because I realized that at one point in the Flavor Flav world of in Flavor of Love, the season two finale was the second highest rated show that was non-sports for basic cable that year in 2006. And I'm realizing that this was a nice transition into back then we were just, and when it came to basic cable, you had FX that had Nip Tuck and The Shield, but that's pretty much it. Like AMC was just running Jurassic Park reruns all the time. They didn't have Mad Men yet.
I was going to say till post writer's strike. And then I know that a lot of these shows really took off, and that's why there's so many spinoffs. I mean, we obviously didn't include all of them. We're going to be talking about The Surreal Life, Flavor of Love, I Love New York, and Celeb Fit Club. But there are so many spinoffs. I'd forgotten. Yes. There were some. I think the genius of a lot of this, and I'll get to it a little bit in the Surreal Life part of my recap, but these are ingenious because they're all like 6 episodes long. Like, this is pre-Quibi. Like, that's what it feels like to me.
For sure.
They knew exactly the correct formula to put together like C-list celebrities and then recycling old reality stars for new shows. It really is quite interesting when you step back, because as it's happening, you're just sort of like used to it, because for whatever reason, well, not whatever reason, it's more like VH1 trained their audience pretty well to sort of like expect there to always kind of be like a new reality series coming up all the time.
Yeah. And my other thing that, you know, is unfortunate is that they clearly picked not only C-list celebrities, but C-list celebrities who had a multitude of other issues and really the winner of this whole ordeal is Dr. Drew, because he had so many people to put on his show, Celeb Rehab with Dr. Drew, which I'll get into a little bit I go into my stuff.
But Emily, that rehab center like closed down because they violated like a bunch of laws and shit too. So I don't know if he's necessarily the winner.
I actually think
the real winner might be New York, because she made a lot of money. And I will obviously talk – I won't talk about this actually, because I mostly just focus on her show. But she made a lot of money. She got out while the getting is good, and now she's just sort of like a household name. So she just like makes that sweet coin doing appearances and shit because everybody loves her. The thing that only makes me upset a little bit are that obviously these cursed Gen Z – just kidding. I mean, children of the future, et cetera, et cetera. But they only know New York as like a gif. Like obviously that gif of her sitting on that bed in Flavor of Love with her sunglasses on just staring off has been – that's where most kids, quote unquote, oh my God, granny.
That's like
over here. That's where they know her from. And that like truly blows my fucking mind.
Digital folklore right there, Margot. Digital folklore. Like this is what has happened, is that we have this Gen Z group of kids who use GIFs of people that they don't even know. They just know them as this GIF. But we know them as these reality TV show contestants from 10, 15, even 20 years ago at this point. That's pretty incredible. That's insane to me that people know things just from meme references now rather than actual source material.
I mean, I can't really blame them though, because sometimes I am like, oh, that's that meme.
I'm
realizing that something's like a source material, but it is just kind of a little bit odd because you're like, this is New York, okay?
Yes.
Pay some motherfucking respect.
Bow down.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue, because during this time when everyone is rewatching Outbreak and Contagion, the patient zero of this particular episode is definitely Surreal Life. The Surreal Life was created by Chris Abrego, Mark Cronin, and Rick Tellis, and originally premiered on the WB in 2003. So I think that's also part of it too. Maybe that's why you don't have any recollection of getting into it on VH1, because it actually started on the WB. Pre-CW, so maybe that merger is what initially broke it.
Yeah.
But that was just really interesting to me because I remember watching all of season one, but I thought it was VH1 because that's just how it is organized in my memory palace, but turns out we were wrong. Mm-hmm. The Surreal Life aimed to be a combination of Real World and Road Rules. Just swap out the people who look like someone you go to college with for actors from a Nick at Night show that you barely remember, and you have The Surreal Life. Abrego, Cronin, and Tellis initially pitched this concept, calling it Surreal World, but to avoid legal issues, they changed it. And once Surreal Life moved to VH1, Abrego and Cronin will go on to be single-handedly responsible for the entire quote-unquote celeb reality universe on VH1. So a quick aside about these two dudes. They started a production company called 51 Minds, which to this day still produces a lot of reality shows. And they sold their production company to Endemol in 2008. Endemol is another huge reality show production powerhouse, whatever you want to call them. They do huge shows like American Idol and America's Got Talent. And so they sold 51 Minds to them in 2008 for $200 million. But they still produce reality TV shows to this day, but not necessarily together. Most importantly to me, Mark Cronin produces the very excellent Below Deck and Below Deck Med. No one gives a shit about that fucking sailing yacht spinoff. What a fucking snooze. But both men really got their start in reality on MTV, which makes a ton of sense when you think about the formula of all of the reality shows that they will go on to create for VH1. Cronin started out on Singled Out, and Abrigo started with Bunham and Murray, who do Real World and Road Rules, hence yep. Surreal Life. So all I'm trying to say is these two dudes know to make very watchable shows, so it's not incredibly surprising that in their slate of celebrity reality shows that ran from 2003 to 2008, not only shaped that time in TV, but also is responsible a little bit for the consistent onslaught of D-list celebrity reality shows that we continue to have right now. So what's interesting to me is both shows that I talk about didn't have a lot of episodes. For some reason at the time, it felt like they went on forever, but I think it's just because similar to what like The Bachelor sometimes does when it's not interrupted by a pandemic is that you'll go like The Bachelor into The Bachelorette, into The Bachelor in Paradise, into The Bachelor. So you don't really have like a ton of time to think about things. And actually maybe Bravo is a better a model of this because like once one housewife show ends, then like as soon as when you get to like the second part of the reunion, a new housewife show will start. And then halfway through that, you'll get a different housewife show. So everybody's staggered at a certain point. So you're always kind of feeling like it's never ending seasons. But when you really think about it, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills could definitely take a lesson from the celebrity reality world, because what they accomplish in 20 episodes, these shows do in 10, 7 episodes every season. Anyway, moving on to the first season of Surreal Life. I just thought it was really interesting because for some reason in my mind, I thought these went on for like 45 episodes.
Me too. Like no, I think like my
6 episodes, just 6, 7, episodes.
Yeah. At most. And that's what's crazy to me.
They are an hour long, but they feel very short. It's sort of like when you go back and I talk about this a little bit, but you go back and watch like old Drag Race or old America's Next Top Model with the commercials taken out. And it's like a tight 45. It's kind of the same thing with these ones too.
No, and I was going to say that for me, at least, I think the daunting thing about trying to get in – sounds daunting when talking about trying to get into a Housewives franchise, which I probably will during this time, is just the sheer amount of episodes each season versus these older shows from like 10, 15 years ago that I watched. I saw everything because there were no more than 8 to 10 episodes that I had to watch.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was because it was in constant reruns too, but there's something that just made it seem like, yeah, that it was just more than that, but I guess not. Because the first season of Surreal Life only had 7 episodes, but it felt like it went on for a year. Maybe some of it was also like the newness as well. But the first season of Surreal Life premiered January 9th, 2003 and starred Gabrielle Cardieras, Andrea from 90210, MC Hammer of Too Legit to Quit, Corey Feldman of... You know, the fucking Feldman. I don't really, if you don't know who he is, don't look it up. It's going to bum you out. Emmanuel Lewis, who was best known for Webster. Jerry Manthe, who was on Survivor Australian Outback. I've never seen a single second of Survivor, so I have no fucking clue who any of these Survivor people are. Vince Neil and Brand Roderick, who was a Baywatch Playboy person. And that's like a reoccurring theme. They always throw in like the quintessential like hot person who you're like, who is this again? You have no clue. And it's always, there's like a Baywatch and or Playboy and or both link.
Yes, that's so true.
The first season and all of the subsequent seasons are shot over 2 weeks with the celebs all living together in Glen Campbell's former mansion. Glen Campbell was like a country singer and TV show host in like the 60s.
Oh yeah. R.I.P. Yeah.
They participated in Survivor in over the course of the first season, they participated in Survivor-inspired camping trip, a trip to Las Vegas, and of course, drama with Corey Feldman, who married his girlfriend in the season finale. Mindy Cohen was scheduled to be a cast member but dropped out right before taping, and Robin Givens was also offered a slot on the cast but declined. The show ended in February of 2003. The fun fact about season one is that Bill Hader worked as a PA on this season. He tells a really good story. Yes, on a late night show, I think it's Colbert, about how he watched Corey Feldman stop mid-full sob to take direction for a producer. And like, he just stopped and was like, what was that? Oh, okay, yeah, sure. And then went back to sobbing, was like, why? Like took the director's note, which I was like, that is wild. And he acts that way better than I just did. But I strongly suggest hunting down that clip if you're interested.
Will be doing.
So every season, and I will obviously point it out when it happens, but every season will go on to premiere a year later in January. So season two premieres in 2004 and is the shortest one with 6 episodes. And it starred this time around Tracy Bingham from Baywatch, Trishelle Cantanella from Real World Las Vegas.
Oh, Trishelle.
This was such a bizarre cast. Erica Estrada, Tammy Faye Chips. Messner, a.k.a. Tammy Faye Baker, Ron Jeremy, and Vanilla Ice.
I remember this season, like, vividly.
Well, how could you forget? This was, as I wrote in my notes, the season full of loose cannons. Yeah. Here are some highlights. We had Ron Jeremy has a porn star pool party. Vanilla Ice hoists Gary Coleman above a deep fryer and insists that the former child star recite his catchphrase, "What you talking about, Willis?" which leads Coleman to understandably quit the show. They introduced a show within a show called Dirty Laundry, which was the Surreal Life talk show hosted by Sally Jesse Raphael, just to add another fucking layer of surrealness. Raphael, in one of the episodes, focused on Trishelle making several unflattering remarks about her drinking problem and then told her that she acted like a slut. It's just like another theme throughout all these celebrity shows is that they just say things that would never be said in current times or that you would just get yelled at. Like you could not, I guess on a Real Housewife show, you could definitely call a fellow Real Housewife an alcoholic and a slut. But if you're hosting a talk show within a sub-reality show and you told somebody they were an alcoholic slut, that's just like not really going to vibe with everybody else, I don't think.
Big surprise.
My last bullet point as a highlight is they go to a nudist resort and Tammy Faye cries. I don't know why that tickled me, but I like looked up the pictures and I was like, I do remember this episode. Season 3 was, I think they realized they started to have like a hit on their hand. So they expanded this one to be 10 episodes and it premiered in September of 2004 and starred Charo, Dave Coulier, Flavor Flav, Jordan Knight of New Kids on the Block, Brigitte Nielsen, and Ryan Starr, who came in 7th on American Idol. I was like, who the fuck is Ryan Starr? Anyway, memorable moments from this season. There was a recording session for the group to produce an original song, which where the gif of Brigitte Nielsen with the clipboard where she takes off her glasses and is like really exasperated. That's another gif that teens only know like that gif. They don't know that that's Brigitte Nielsen in Surreal Life being exasperated by this group. They had a Surreal Life puppy named Winger after the Detroit Red Wings, which what the fuck?
And oh, that's during Dave Coulier.
Okay. Because I was like, why would that be? I don't understand.
Yeah, they named it. They renamed the dog like 4 times in one episode.
But during an episode of Dirty Laundry, Flav admits to hitting it, which upsets the whole cast. And per Wikipedia, the dog is now age 11, which I don't know when this is because I don't think the dog is 11. Judging by just like time, the dog might no longer be with us, RIP Winger. But at the time of this Wikipedia entry, he was 11, living in Long Beach, and had been given to friends of Dave Coulier after the show. So he was thriving or continues to thrive. We're not sure. But obviously, this season is most memorable because of Brigitte Nielsen and Flavor Flav's romantic relationship. Tons of question marks after that, which would go on to change VH1's programming for the next 5 years. This romance will go on to spawn 14 spinoffs and sequels, starting with Strange Love, and then would go on to snowball from there. Which, that was something that as soon as I saw that, I was like, shit, we forgot Strange Love, because that was such a fucking bizarre
so reality strange.
Show. You had to see it to believe it. And most of the time you're like, I can't tell if they're like truly into each other or if they're just fucking with us.
Well, you know, it starts out on an interesting place when Flavor Flav is on his way to see Brigitte Nielsen, but she is engaged to some much younger man who just doesn't know what the hell is going on.
Oh my God, I forgot. And then didn't she have a baby recently?
Yes, she did in her 50s.
Is truly wild. That was
to be a 6'2 Danish woman with like short bleach blonde hair.
We should do a mini on Strange Love. Just I don't think that there's like a ton there, but I think it's enough to talk about.
That's a tight 15.
Hopefully. So the fourth season, which is the one that of Surreal Life that I actually remember kind of the most clearly, it premiered the following year in September, and it starred Debrat, Adrian Curry, Christopher Knight, China, Marcus Schweckenberg, who is a Swedish model slash actor, Vern Troyer, and Jane Wheelin of the Go-Go's. So things you would definitely remember from the season is Debrat and Jane Wheelin had a beef, which was truly bizarre. Vern Troyer got wasted on the first night and peed in the weight room. You watched China's extremely sad relationship with her ex, Sean Waltman, kind of play out in front of cameras. But much like the season before, it was mainly wrapped up in the romance between Adrian Curry and Peter Brady, and they would eventually get their own spinoff called My Fair Brady. So season five was unique for two reasons. It premiered later that summer. Oh, I'm so sorry. I said that season four premiered in September of the following year. I meant to say January. That is my mistake. But season five is unique for two reasons. One, it premiered later that summer in July instead of January. And two, it has more episodes, actually the most, 13. So this season had Caprice, who's a model, Jose Canseco, Peppa of Salt and Peppa, Janice Dickinson, Carrie Hart, Pink's husband, fucking Omarosa, and Bronchant Pinchot, that's Balky bitch. What I mean, truly. Oh, so I've been rewatching some old America's Next Top Model because it's on Amazon Prime, and I forgot how good that theme song is, but also I forgot how bad Janice Dickinson is as a judge. And rereading highlights about this season, I forgot just how painful it was sometimes to watch her on TV. Like, clearly she's like hamming it up for the cameras, but like there was just some situations that seemed really unhealthy, and her beef with Omarosa on this show that caused her to like leave in one of the final episodes without making up with her was one of the things that like caused you, whenever you watched it, you're like, I just don't feel good watching this play out. Like, this isn't fun anymore.
Yeah. I think so that's when, for me, Surreal Life kind of, I think that might be the last season. Like, I watched it, but I didn't watch a lot of it, if I recall correctly, because it wasn't as much fun as previous seasons had been.
I would totally agree. And I feel like Omarosa was like a little bit of a part of it because she just seems a little bit, you know, she plays up for the cameras. She also comes in during I Love New York too. So clearly like she was just sort of the hired on villain. But Janice also just, I don't know. I just remember watching their relationship being like, this isn't fun anymore. I liked it better with, even though the Vern Troyer stuff was a bit troubling, it was at least, that cast was really funny together because they were all truly so strange and made no sense and had nothing in common. But this season kind of felt a little bit like bordering on cruel. But to jazz it up and to justify the fact that they were double dipping in the same year, they decorated the whole house to look like a fucking circus, and they gave everybody taglines for the intro like they were Real Housewives. They also got another house dog who was a three-legged dog named Lucky. And that was kind of it. The whole crux of that season was just this feud between Omarosa and Janice, and it just wasn't that interesting. So the sixth and final season of Surreal Life started on March 19th, 2006 and starred Alexis Arquette, Cece DeVille of Poison, Steve Harwell of motherfucking Smash Mouth, Sherman Hemsley from The Jeffersons, Maven Huffman, who's a wrestler, and Tawny Katan from Whitesnake video fame, which is, truly like that season. It, like, I guess all reality shows inevitably take a turn for the dark, but the Tawny Katan finale, I left out what happened. But just know that as soon as the season wraps, she will go on to Dr. Drew's Celeb Rehab.
Yes.
And we had someone named Andrea Lowell, who is a Playboy model that rounds out the cast. Florence Henderson also makes appearances as quote-unquote Dr. Flo, who acted as the house therapist. Some memorable moments, but mostly it was just a little bit kind of like, trotting out the horse one last time before you send it off to pasture, so to speak. So they did all the old hits. They shot a music video. They produced and broadcasted their own talk show pilots. They had a battle of bands. But the best part was Alexis Arquette brought a lot of visibility and awareness to the transgender community just by being a part of the Surreal Life. But, you know, Tawny Katan had a dark exit and, as I said, would go on to go to Dr. Drew's Celeb Rehab. And that would be the end of the Surreal Life. And so the Surreal Life, obviously, as I'd said earlier, Brigitte Nielsen and Flavor Flav had strange love together. When their romance didn't quite pan out, they created the show that Emily's going to talk about.
Flavor of Love, which premiered on January 1st, 2006 on VH1 as part of its Celeb Reality lineup. The show was a spinoff of a spinoff in that it was a spinoff of Strange Love, the reality show that chronicled Flavor Flav's short but wild relationship with actress Brigitte Nielsen. That show in turn was a spinoff of The Surreal Life, which Margot just talked to you about, where they originally met. The show Flavor of Love would last for 3 seasons, and during that time, Flavor Flav chose not to marry or date any of the season's winners, eventually announcing during the season 3 final season reunion show that he was going to marry Liz, the mother of his 7th child. The premise of the show followed the template of most dating reality shows on TV, such as The Bachelor and Joe Millionaire, in that in this case, 20 to 25 contestants competed to date Flavor Flav while living in a mansion in Encino, where all great things
what
happen.
What a world. What
the
a
real
world.
Encino man. Flavor Flav had counsel throughout the show in the form of his bodyguard slash chauffeur, Big Rick, his mother, and at times his ex, Brigitte Nielsen, and later Tiffany New York Pollard, who we would get to know after the first season with various spinoffs. Much like The Bachelor, contestants would compete for one-on-one time with Flavor Flav through a series of competitions. The remaining contestants' parents were brought on the show in the third to last or second to last episode, and the final two contestants would spend a night with Flavor Flav in a luxurious resort similar to Fantasy Suites.
Finally, gross.
To learn to know who had been eliminated on the show each episode and who was still on, a weekly elimination ceremony would take place, and instead of handing out roses, remaining contestants were handed out their own clock necklaces, much like the ones Flavor Flav always wears, with the winner ultimately ending up with Flavor Flav. When a contestant was eliminated, her real name was revealed along with a champagne toast. Casting for this show was very interesting, to say the least.
Can I give you a quick sidebar about casting? Because I had a friend who worked in casting as when the show was doing the first season.
Yes.
He was not, let's say he was well-versed in contract speak because he had worked on Fear Factor beforehand. And so they make you sign all sorts of wild disclosures. But I'll never forget, he was working on Flavor of Love and he sent me a picture of one page of what seemed like a phone book size stack of pages that was part of like the Flavor of Love disclosure. And the front page that he sent me was essentially VH1 and all of its production companies waiving liability if you of your own recognizance decide to have sex with Flavor Flav and contract an STD. And then there was just a list of the STDs that you may or may not contract if you have sex with Flavor Flav that they refuse to have any sort of part in. Which it still haunts me to this day because he's like, it goes on for several more pages of all of the other things that they won't sign off on. And he's like, and these women sign it willingly. Little did we know that these women would then morph into probably Instagram influencers, you know, in the future. But that stays with me to this day because it was more so fucking funny.
On that, more on that. Not the STD part, but just like the willingness
of
these women.
That's all that I got.
According to this Vulture interview I read with Mark Cronin, the show's producer, and the guy who would go on to produce all of the VH1 celeb reality shows of that kind of 5 to 10 year period, and casting
Below
associate
deck.
Douglas Howington. They went to cities, they went to clubs and cities known for having people with, quote, eccentric personalities, such as New York, Vegas, Miami, Chicago, and Dallas. As Cronin said, quote, we were looking for women who either knew who he was, by he they mean Flavor or Flav, or were interested in getting involved with someone like him, whether it was because he was an artist, a legend, a millionaire, whichever it was. Wild, end quote. On each season's premiere episode, Flavor Flav had a lot of trouble remembering contestants' names. So to keep track of them, he gave them each nicknames in a setup akin to the sorting hat at Hogwarts. But instead of hoping to be sorted into your house of your dreams, you would hope that you would have a somewhat regular nickname. In these scenes, the girls lined up in the house and one by one came up to Flavor Flav, who was sitting at a table, where he would then christen them with names such as Bucky, Toasty, New York, Wire, Delicious, et cetera, et cetera. These names
Pumpkin, Hottie.
Yes.
And there were some like really racist ones too. Not racist, but like, you know,
these
derogative.
Derogative. These names had some interesting spellings, such as for Delicious, we had D-E-E-L-I-S-H-I-S. And
you could say that they were phonetically spelled most of the time.
Most of the time, and Nibbles, N-I-B-B-L-Z. who is named as such because her lisp reminded Flavor Flav of Mike Tyson, to which she replied that she also nibbles like him, referencing the Holyfield ear incident.
I mean, honestly, I watched Flavor of Love for the naming. I always thought that was the best part.
Best episode.
Much like the very first episode of The Bachelor is always the best because you meet all of these women dressed like sloths or popping out of suitcases and all that wild shit.
Yep.
After that, it's like fucking diminishing returns. But up until that, it's very funny. And him naming them was always hysterical because, yes, he would come up with ways to spell things that you're like, huh. I guess
I
that's
see it.
The word. Exactly. It really is like phonics. The phonetic spelling in like the dictionary. You're like, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense phonetically.
That's sort of, yeah, I guess if you were a student of Hooked on Phonics, I could see where that comes up. The most fascinating thing to watch on this show is just how into Flavor Flav many of these women are. In fact, in the aforementioned Vulture interview, the writer asked Mark Cronin about the legitimacy of how much it looked like these contestants were into him. And he responded, quote, "One of the biggest questions you always get is, well, come on, could they really be into Flavor Flav? Always the answer to this question, were they really into that into him, is yes. When you take a group of people, take them away from their homes, take away their cell phones and television, and their phone calls are bugged, and there's this one guy who shows up and decides whether you'll get to eat a nice dinner tonight or whether you're going to be in a limo with him, it's like Stockholm Syndrome, and they become very quickly caught up in it. You'll actually even see that when somebody gets eliminated from one of these shows, they kind of snap out of it very quickly, like suddenly realize, what was I thinking?" Revisiting this show, personally, a lot
Wait,
of this...
Wait, hold on. Thank you, Mark Cronin, because now Camille Grammer GIF, we said it. Because I was going to say, sir, you are describing Stockholm Syndrome right now.
In fact,
but also, I think it's like really funny when you think about like even just this Bachelor season when Kelly got eliminated. It was like she snapped out of it. Like she was already not super in it, but she was like, man, fuck that guy. He fucking sucks. Yeah. So I was like,
it's so true.
Correct.
It's so true.
Anyway, you were going to say, sorry.
Yes. No, sorry. Personally, when I was revisiting this show this week, a lot of this does, in fact, feel like a cult. And maybe
someone... Speaking of Tiger King, it goes full circle.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of similarities here. Someone is kept in a house with other people, away from the outside world and from contact with loved ones. They are then stripped of their identity and assigned a new name, which, hello, Manson family, or hello, our friend at the Myrtle Beach Zoo, and then grow to love their leader figure and are pushed to extreme behavior they would have never considered in the outside world. Like, this very much reads like a cult when you watch it again, especially after I have listened to so many cult podcasts and watched so many cult docuseries. Of course, the show was a huge hit for VH1, with the second season's finale, as I was saying earlier, being the second highest rated non-sports basic cable show of 2006, which, like I said earlier, I think it's probably because back then prestige TV just hadn't really hit cable, basic cable yet. Like, you either had your network hits or you went to HBO. Maybe a year or two after this is when you really start to see Mad Men, Breaking Bad, FX comes out with more TV shows, AMC becomes a big hit network. So it's a very different...
I would even say
landscape.
That reality TV was less competitive then too, because
too.
During the time of some of these shows, like Surreal Life predates Real Housewives of Orange County. Yeah. I mean, of course we had like Survivor. We had like all the staples, Big Brother, Real World, all of that, but there wasn't a ton of new stuff. There weren't reality shows that came out all of the time, like a Love is Blind
or
Family Karma. Yeah.
They didn't have
that
the,
was
like,
pre
that
the edit.
Edit,
too.
Right.
Yeah.
So you get the crazy contestants, sure, but it still feels very kind of low budget. And there's, you know, clearly whoever it's VH1 made this into a hit is a genius, because you know the budget was not great on this. Like, they're not going to destinations on Flavor of Love. They are staying in
the
house.
No.
Parents come
to Chile.
They're not going
to demonstrate third grade Spanish. No, there are no hometown dates. That's really what's kind of like some of the more striking stuff about it. I as I said, I was like rewatching some old America's Next Top Model. And the first couple of seasons, you really see how little money they have. Like, they truly have like a tarp from Party City as a backdrop. And you're like, wow. And they just made it work because it really didn't matter, because we were there
matter.
For the content, because nobody really knew what they were doing.
No one
So it really
knew.
Is like reality TV in its purest form. And I think that's why Flavor of Love is kind of like holds for some strange reason, and also yes. was so popular then, was it was a satire, but didn't make you feel stupid the way that like Joe Millionaire did, or like any of those other kind of like stunty reality shows or dating shows that were on like the bigger networks. Yeah. It was like a good spoof before Burning Love, but was like kind of sincere-ish of like The Bachelor. And I think a lot of people gravitated towards that.
Ultimately, this show was responsible for a string of similar dating reality shows and spinoffs, such as I Love New York, starring Tiffany New York Pollard, Rock of Love, starring Brett Michaels, which I very much thought about like doing a little research on instead of Celebrity Fit Club, and Real Chance of Love.
Well, we should definitely, we 100% need to circle back, because I think Rock of Love is hilarious. I also forgot how much I loved Charm School with Monique.
Yes.
They had too many shows.
Real Chance of Love. Which starred those like two brothers, and then Flavor of Love, Charm School, I Love Money. Just the list goes on and on. Well,
honestly, just the, I will touch on it a touch, but a touch on it, a touch. But I Love Money and the whole murderer associated with that show that essentially ended Celebrity just to begin with because it was a liability. It is insane. It's truly an embarrassment of riches. We'll have to do a follow-up episode and some minis on certain ones, because there was a lot. Once I started to peel back one layer of this fucking onion, you just like find all these other shows. You're like, oh yeah, I was obsessed with that and obsessed with that. And that was amazing. And this is also terrible.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just the revisiting of it all is just like, wow, there was just, they were pumping out content, just like so many spinoffs. I'm just going to kind of go into one or two last things for this, and then a few of contestant highlights for me. And then I'll let you go into I Love New York. But the week following the finale every season, an all cast reunion typically aired. And the host was Lala Vasquez, who is now Lala Anthony. And she would spend this time reviewing the most memorable moments and interviewing the contestants.
I think she's just Lala now because they got divorced.
Oh, right.
Her and Carmelo aren't together anymore.
Ah, yes.
Classic NBA problem.
Well, and also amazing what happens in like less than 15 years. This is also when the viewer finds out if Flav is still with the woman he chose and what they had been up to since the season wrapped. Spoiler alert, he never stayed with any of the finalists. And VH1 also introduced an internet component to the show where viewers could create profiles, interact with contestants and other fans, and stay current with news at flavorofloveworld.com. That's an interesting thing to me, was like once upon a time, there was such a strange online companion component to these shows. Nowadays, that would be like akin to having our Facebook groups for podcasts and that kind of thing. But really back then, I feel like it's amazing how many of these TV shows, like the network's website, would have a dedicated, almost like Second Life component to it on that website. And then in season 3, fans even got to vote online to elect 5 of the contestants, though Flav sent 4 of them home in the premiere episode. I'll just quickly dive into like a handful of contestants, and then we'll go into I Love New York. So obviously Flavor Flav was the main person, whose real name I didn't realize was William Jonathan Drayton Jr. Tiffany Pollard, obviously, New York, was the runner-up of both the first and second seasons. After the show, she'll go on to I Love New York. As well as New York Goes to Hollywood.
Best moment for New York truly was when that bitch pumpkin spat on her and she almost ripped her fucking face off.
Yes.
That is classic, a legend was reality born. TV. She is a legend.
So one other thing that came up in that interview on Vulture was just really great quotes. The interviewer asks, the interviewer asks them, you may have scored one of the greatest reality show casting coups of all time when you found Tiffany Pollard, aka New York. How did you find her? Howington, the casting guy, is saying, I didn't find Tiffany. I would love to know who did. This is actually something two of my casting friends and I have talked about through the years. Who found Tiffany Pollard? I thought she was a great marketer of her talent, her quote unquote talent. Whatever it is, she wasn't. She was just a walking time bomb of awesomeness for reality TV. And then Cronin goes on to say, she was a reality television genius. You could see why Flavor would really fall for her. And then with other women who were competition, she was absolutely vicious. I'll go into maybe 2 more people, and then I will hand it off to you. There was also Hoops, who was the winner of the first season, aka Nicole Alexander. After the show, she started acting and modeling. They broke up soon after the show ended. She went on to I Love Money, winning the grand prize of $250,000. And she dated Shaquille O'Neal, so not bad.
I'm like, she also went on to date Shaq, because her name was Hoops because she was like a basketball player. there. Not like with the WNBA or anything, but she just liked to play basketball. I really do think that we're underselling New York, who we could totally have an entire episode about, because she really did create a character on reality TV that has withstood the test of time when these kinds of shows are supposed to be disposable. But for me, some of my favorite New York moments from Flavor of Love, mostly it's her screaming at Hottie when she says, "I think I look like Beyonce." And she screams, "Beyonce? Beyonce?" She's like, "You look like Luther Vandross." And then the other one, the other gift that I always send of New York to other people is when she's been sitting at the table and like bitches are trying to try her. And she's just like eating a steak and like holding up like a doll steak knife. And she's like half laughing, half being menacing. But you know she's not going to do anything. You know she's doing it for the camera. And that's what makes it so fucking good.
So good.
More people need to study at the School of New York and get their fucking reality TV show characters together, because she was ahead of her time.
Ahead of her time. And then the final two people I'll go into, Delicious, really quickly, who won the second season. She later would have gone to
Are you doing a Delish where she is now?
Yes. She would later go on to have her own line of jeans called D-Cut and then participate in a 2009 national tour of the Vagina Monologues with an all-black cast, most of whom were also former reality TV show contestants.
Oh, I'm pretty sure an Atlanta housewife was in that.
Finally, Hottie, aka Shatar Taylor, appeared on Flavor of Love, would go on to be on Charm School. And turns out Hottie actually went to University of Pennsylvania, where Mark Cronin had also gone to. And he couldn't believe that this woman had gone to the same school as him. She literally, there's a scene in which she tried to microwave a raw chicken, if that gives you any indication of how strange that she had an Ivy League education. I don't feel like diving into any others.
You totally forgot the best part about Delish. She is engaged to one of the Central Park Five.
Oh my God, you're right.
Yes. Remember, everybody was like, wow, that's so interesting that they're dating. How'd they even meet? And then they're like, turned around, they were engaged. I think they met at some sort of rally for victims or a fundraiser. I'm totally botching it. If you just go to their Instagrams, they talk about how they met and everything. But it's very cute and super sweet. But yeah, that I think is the most interesting glow up out of all of them. I mean, way to go from Flav to the opposite of Flav.
Yes.
Flav, who is like about to get kicked out of his half of Public Enemy because –
He wouldn't appear in the Bernie. Chuck D was mad that he
was about to like kick him out.
Yeah.
I almost called him D Nice because I keep seeing all of these things about D Nice and his DJing. And so like my brain is a little bit fried.
It's been a rough couple of weeks. That's acceptable.
Has it been a couple of weeks? Like what day is it even? If it wasn't for birth control, which I immediately forget what day it is as soon as I like pop out a pill. But if it wasn't for birth control, I would not know even a little bit what day it is. Bless my computer that I'm always like 25th. Wait, was sort of the 23rd was like a few days ago. Okay, I think I know what's happening. Technically, if this were like real, like regular, like uninterrupted life, I was supposed to be going on vacation tomorrow. But now my vacation is like maybe I'll just lay in bed till noon because what's the point? I'm not trying to bring it down.
No,
one great thing about self-isolation life is that I rediscovered I Love New York is on Hulu. So I watched probably half of the first season of I Love New York yesterday, and it was pretty good. I would say it definitely holds up. So I just have one question. Do you have love for New York? Because New York is in the motherfucking house. I loved New York because she was one of the first, I guess you could say, quote unquote, romantic leads who said fuck a lot, which I obviously identify with as somebody who loves the word fuck. And I just thought that she was always one of the funniest people on Flavor of Love. She had the best comebacks. And truly, she went easy on Pumpkin when she spat in her face. I think everybody can agree on that. But it was nice after seeing New York get brought back. Well, especially in the second season when Flav rejects her and picks Delish. Is it Delicious or is it Delish?
It's Delicious.
Okay, when Flav picks Delicious over New York and she's crying like, why did you bring me back, Flav? Why would you do this to me? I think a lot of people could relate to that. And I think that was probably New York's most human moment where we're like, yeah, she's beyond this caricature of a person. And I think that I Love New York kind of like showcased her like caricature, but also with some soft sides. But she's very no nonsense. And that's what I love about her. So I Love New York is all about her quest to find true love. And she is our original Black Bachelorette. I'm very sorry, Rachel Lindsay. But New York is the Black Bachelorette that we deserve. She has pithy comebacks. She has no tolerance for bullshit. And she can make up her mind quickly. I really do love that Rachel Lindsay cried off her lashes for Peter. But, you know, it was just sort of like a letdown that she picked who she picked. Whereas New York, it didn't really matter who she picked. We just wanted to see her happy. First of all, one thing that stood out to me that made her an unconventional rom-com lead was that she chain smokes menthols, and that's what makes her a fucking legend. Not only that, but her mother, who also chain smokes, joined her, Sister Patterson. And if you want to talk about similarities to the Bachelor universe, Barb wishes she was a quarter as terrifying as Sister Patterson. In the first season, New York is also joined by her cabana boy, Chamo. But I just really want to circle back to Sister Patterson, who is also just, you can tell where New York gets her blunt opinions from, who would just straight up tell her things like, that guy's butt looks too much like a girl's butt, and if the two of you were wearing similar pants, I wouldn't be able to tell who was who from behind. There's also an episode where Omarosa guest stars and helps New York figure out who is the richest bachelor among them. And the loser who has the least amount of money has to go on a dinner date with Sister Patterson. And it's this guy who's like clearly going through some things. He starts off his whole presentation by saying, here's the thing, I'm broke. And everybody starts laughing, but he clearly takes it personal instead of realizing that it's funny and it seemed funny and they thought he was in on the joke, but he wasn't. Anyway, Sister Patterson is truly one of a kind.
Indeed. Oh, I forgot how much I loved her.
Oh my God, she's so terrifying. There's like a scene in the first episode where she's like chain smoking outside with I believe his name is Romance. He has recently lost his dog and he's like really upset about it. But Sister Patterson thinks that's very endearing. So she's smoking and hanging out outside. And then she fucking hates Chance the entire time. And so Chance comes in and, you know, interrupts or butts in or whatever. And Sister Patterson completely fucking chews him out. She blows smoke in his face. And I was like, oh my God, I forgot how great this show is. Like, this is like the kind of like endorphin rush that I'm looking for that I got from Love is Blind, which is like no fucking courting, none of this like pretending to be polite bullshit. Like, no, we're getting like straight to the matter of everything. Like, let's go. So I Love New York follows a very similar format to Flavor of Love, where New York gives all of the guys a nickname. The reveal of what their real names are at the end when they get voted off is always my favorite, because it's always like, his name is, I don't know, like Mr. Boston. It's like, his name's Chris. You're like, maybe you should just go by Mr. Boston. Like, that's probably better for you. I mean, she names a white guy Token and then another white guy simply White Boy. I rewatched the first episode, as I had mentioned, on Hulu. Again, definitely worth a rewatch, worth your time. And there are two things that really make the hair stand up on the back of your neck when you hear it. It's really tough to say that, because there is also, as I had mentioned, a man crying about the dog that he recently lost, that he's now going to transfer all of that loving energy onto New York because she's his princess now. So that's cool. But wait, it gets so much worse. First, the aforementioned Mr. Boston calls another contestant the hard R word. And then Rico tells New York that he's going to call her his quote unquote Negrita, which she immediately shuts down, thank fucking God, but was still extremely cringeworthy, was just deeply upsetting, especially when everybody else was yelling, please don't say that to her. And he said, no, I charge ahead regardless. Again, I'm rewatching America's Next Top Model, and they recently had a photo shoot on the fourth season where all of the white, predominantly white models had to be quote unquote ethnically ambiguous. So like, I just think it's par for the course for this time. I'm not saying it excuses it. I'm just saying that all of these reality shows were losing their mind at the same time. Again, this is just a deranged version of The Bachelorette, or actually a more honest version. And I think that the mission statement of I Love New York is distilled in New York's parting speech to the contestants on the first night who didn't get past the first elimination round, which the mansion, by the way, looks like a frat house because it has like a sheet draped over the front of it. But the wallpaper on the inside is really cool because it looks like a Louis Vuitton logo, but instead of LV, it says NY. But I couldn't figure out, I couldn't make heads or tails of this house. It has like a big hedge and it looks really cool and kind of like woodland. And then there's just like a sheet draped over the front, which makes me feel like they're hiding something underneath that. But this is New York's speech to her contestants that didn't make it past the first night. For the five here that don't have a chain, don't think you didn't touch me. But the truth of the matter is, you're just not good enough for me, in a talking head aside. One was here for acting, one was a fucking pansy, and one couldn't control his eye sockets. The other two, they just weren't good enough for me, so they just had to get the fuck up out my place. Chris Harrison wishes. And that's right. Instead of roses or clocks, she gave the men who advanced a giant chain that said, I love New York on it. The season one winner, Tango, aka Patrick Hunter, sadly turned out to not be New York's soulmate. So they greenlit a season two, duh. And then season two premiered in October of the same year, 2007. Maybe it was the extra episode. Season two had 13 versus 12, but she picked TaylorMade, aka George Weisenberger, but they'd later break up on the next New York spinoff, New York Goes to Hollywood. I was going to do a Where Are They Now, the contestants, but it proved to be either mild or just straight up depressing. But the only notable thing that I wanted to relay to the masses was that Punk, aka David Otunga, is Jennifer Hudson's ex-husband. And that was the only interesting thing of note.
I totally forgot about that.
He looks exactly the same. You're like, how did I miss that? That just seems very obvious.
Wow.
So more interesting than the Where Are They Nows is the sheer amount of spinoffs from New York alone. So we have Real Chance of Love with the two brothers from season one, Chance, who was the runner-up, and Real, who sadly passed in 2015, I believe, from colon cancer or liver cancer. Excuse me, I didn't write it down. Then there is Frank the Entertainer, quote, dot, 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 A Basement Affair. Frank the Entertainer was on the second season. And then we have the New York-based spinoffs. There is New York Goes to Hollywood, New York Goes to Work. And then there was going to be I Love New York 3, but it was canceled because basically Megan Wants a Millionaire / I Love Money ruins the party. So the end of the I Love New York era at VH1 as we know it kind of goes a little bit like this. New York Goes to Work premiered in May of 2009. And it followed her on her search to find a regular job. After the finale, the viewers were asked to vote on what she should do next. Should she do I Love New York 3, take a vacation, or find a real job? And everybody voted for I Love New York 3. But that was put on an indefinite hold, which, sorry if that's super triggering. That's especially a triggering phrase to me currently. But it was put on an indefinite hold because, well, there's no easy way to put this, but a contestant on I Love Money and Megan Wants a Millionaire was a murderer. He murdered his girlfriend and then eventually killed himself. He was abusing her and had embezzled money and was just in tons of trouble. And it happened in San Diego because all terrible things apparently happen in San Diego. And that is kind of what took down the whole celeb reality empire that was going on at VH1 at the time. And then they just kind of like pivoted to whatever they're doing now. I Love Hip Hop, I believe. And some other shows, they like share a crossover with MTV, obviously, because they're owned by Viacom. But yeah, so that was how the I Love New York era ended on VH1. That's how Celeb Reality ended, because it just ended up being a giant liability. They couldn't believe that they had missed all of his criminal offenses in a background check. But as somebody who watches 90 Day Fiancé, and on the current season, there is a guy who has been accused of rape by two of his three ex-wives, and there's like a suspicion of murder against him about his dead toddler. I'm just trying to say that sometimes producers maybe don't care, or not everything gets brought up, but either way, maybe triple, quadruple check if you're just sort of like putting a bunch of money in shows. Better safe than sorry. Yeah,
I am going to try to easy breezy cover Celebrity Fit Club, because this is probably the least exciting of the celeb reality shows, unfortunately. As you guys might remember, it's a TV series which followed eight overweight celebrities as they tried to lose weight. And I should probably point out, this follows a little bit of The Biggest Loser. What's interesting is that it's based on a British show which aired on ITV from 2002 to 2006 with British celebrities. And then Biggest Loser premiered in 2004. So I really thought that Celeb Fit Club was based on Biggest Loser, but it turns out I think the first one was the British Celebrity Fit Club. But the formats are very similar, where you have, you know, overweight people competing against one another. Premise of the show is this: contestants are split into two competing teams of four members. Each week, teams are given different physical challenges and their members are weighed to see if they've reached their target goal weights. Contestants are monitored and then supervised by a team of experts, including a nutritionist, psychologist, a physical trainer. The series was hosted by Ant, the comedian, until season 7, who I had forgotten about, but you might remember him as a contestant on Last Comic Standing, which was hosted by Jay Moore, who was also at Spidey's wedding, as you may remember, we found out when we interviewed Zoe. Old millennials, reality TV universe, baby.
All we need is Peter Gallagher's eyebrows, and we have bingo.
Sadly, he did not make an appearance in Celeb Reality. At one point during each of the first,
I feel like he missed it by like a hair strand.
Just a couple of brow strands. Team trade-offs were initiated throughout the season. There was like a mid-season team trade-off where the Fit Clubbers voted one member off their team. The teammate with the most votes was then traded to the other team. And in the case of a tie, it was the captain who would make the final vote. And then after season 1, they had a new rule that prohibited Fit Clubbers from voting for themselves. And then the season twist, or in season 5, to balance the gender-based teams, they added a twist which allowed traded Fit Clubbers to choose a teammate from their old team to join the new team. And it feels kind of like they would try to kind of change things up towards the later end of the seasons, because this show was probably exciting for the first few seasons, but over time, it's a lot of repeat people who come back. You'll probably remember Ant, of course, who's the host. The other kind of notable people were the drill instructor, Harvey Walden, the fourth. He's the really kind of hard-headed guy who's like yelling at the contestants. And then Dr. Ian K. Smith was probably one of the more notable people because he's had his own show after this. And then Dr. Marissa Peer, who was on the first season, but later as a psychologist, and then later replaced with Dr. Linda Papadopoulos. And I'm so sorry, I mispronounced that Greek name. The most notable contestant from the show, obviously, was Dustin Diamond. He was the absolute worst. He regularly mocked fellow contestants, disrespected the coaches and Ant. There was even an episode which, during a weigh-in, they showed footage of him at an adult film expo because he had just notably been in a porn film. So he was at an adult film expo where he picked up a dildo to imply that he was going to get it for Kimberly Locke, who I think at the time was singing a lot of like Christian gospel music. So this actually caused her to cry and walk off the set during the weigh-in. Diamond's behavior caused 6 contestants to leave the room after that. And after Ant chastises him for his behavior, he threatens wanting to fight Ant. This leads to a showdown with Drill Sergeant Harvey, who loses his shit, and who could blame him? There is a reason why Dustin Diamond is the worst and is not a part of any of the Saved by the Bell reunions. He sucks. Harvey threatens to beat up Diamond after Diamond says he wants to take him down, which, like, sure, Jan, like, you would stand a chance. In a later episode.
I remember that. And yeah. I feel like, do you remember maybe it was like 5 years ago when Dustin Diamond got stabbed? And I was knew when you challenged that dude to a fight in Celeb Fit Club that you were never going to win.
Had it coming. In a later episode, Dr. Ian K. Smith, one of the experts at the weigh-in, after Diamond has lost over 10 pounds on the show, I think he's lost maybe close to 20, he congratulates Diamond, but also expresses his concern over Dustin Diamond using diet pills to make it happen rather than actually doing the work and exercising and eating healthy. And then, you know, talks about how his cholesterol will stay up. He's at risk for heart disease, so on and so forth. And Diamond just gives him the, I'm sorry you feel that way, and basically says he's sorry for not losing weight a doctor's way to help him make money. So Diamond is completely insufferable the whole time. But other notable contestants included Jeff Conaway, who was clearly on drugs during the filming and had a breakdown during one of the weigh-in ceremonies that they had to keep filming over and over again because he's like biting his shirt and having it pulled up to expose his stomach. He's rude and hostile towards the panelists and other contestants. He would later leave halfway through the show to enter rehab and then will show up in Celeb Rehab with Dr. Drew. Another notable person
was
Gary.
All of our troubled Celeb Reality stars end up.
a lot of them ended up on this show. So Gary Busey, who was also dealing with substance abuse, and Busey actually will show up on Celeb Rehab with Dr. Drew, thinking that he's supposed to be a mentor, but really he's there because he needs to be at rehab as well. Ultimately, this show really saddens me because of the number of contestants who have since died, including Ralphie May from Last Comic Standing, Jeff Conaway, Janie Lane from the band Warrant. There were several other contestants on this show and then later Celeb Rehab who ended up passing away. It's also worth noting, like I said, a lot of these people end up on Celeb Rehab, Dr. Drew, and also people who were in Surreal Life, including Jeff Conaway, Brigitte Nielsen, Gary Busey, and Tawny Kitaen. And the list goes on and on, but those were just a few that I caught. But as you were mentioning people on Surreal Life, I was like, oh, I remember seeing them on the list for Celeb Rehab with Dr. Drew. So some of the other notable contestants from season one, there's Ralphie May, Wendy Kaufman, who's the Snapple lady, Daniel Baldwin, one of the Baldwin model brothers. Season two included Jack A. Harry, who is responsible for some of the greatest 2 to 3 minutes of television ever in her appearance on Watch What Happens Live with Regina King, where she and Regina have had way too much to drink and are just hilarious. I highly recommend you all search for that after this episode. It also included the late Janie Lane, who is the lead singer of Warrant, as well as Gary Busey's first appearance on Celeb Fit Club. And then other notable people from that season, the Snapple lady showed up again. And then Victoria Jackson, you might know. Yeah, SNL, who later has gone on to be a Fox News regular, which, gross. Season three.
I was oh-yeah-ing the Snapple lady because I forgot that's how I developed like an affinity for the Snapple lady period was getting to know her on this show.
Right. She was one of the tamer people, to say the least.
She seemed really nice and super normal. I think that's why I was like, I just want her to succeed, whatever her goals may be.
Exactly. Season three, I mean, as each season goes on, it kind of gets like the list gets, after season three, it gets a little less interesting. So season three had Kelly LeBrock, had Countess Vaughn, Gunnar Nelson, who was in the band Nelson, and he came in, I believe, to replace Jeff Conaway because Jeff Conaway leaves mid-season after he goes to enter rehab and just shows up to weigh-ins completely drugged out of his mind. Young MC was another person on there, as well as Chaz Bono and Bruce Vilanch, which we don't see Bruce often anymore, but he was a great head. I feel like he was in a lot of
Another person who I had discovered through this VH1 show that I didn't even know I had liked so much of his writing for so long until the show. It did do some good, I guess, for notoriety's sake or putting a face to a name kind of thing. But it is interesting how this celebrity show doesn't really endure the way that like a Flavor of Love, which I think maybe has kind of like a more general theme where like things like this and like Biggest Loser and stuff have lost a lot of their sheen because they feel so fat shaming. Well, they fat-shaming.
And that's what before my internet started crapping out, that's actually what I talked about was ultimately, I think that this show is not worth a rewatch. First off, it doesn't, after the first few seasons, a lot of the people are not as entertaining as they were in the first couple seasons, which unfortunately in most cases is because these people had drug abuse issues. But it's also that
they transitioned to Dr. Drew.
Exactly. That's really sad. And then on top of that, it's just like weight loss shows are so strange to watch, 15, 20 years later, where people get consistently get called out as fat on this show. And it's not in the sense of where people now, a lot of people have taken that word and to use it as a descriptor, rather as a demeaning term. In this case, it's clearly meant in a demeaning way. And I mean, there's a reason why in 2020, whenever Jillian Michaels does an interview, everyone afterwards on Twitter is like, fuck you, because her rhetoric doesn't work. That fat shaming rhetoric is just not a part of our landscape as much anymore. And thank God, I'm glad to know that we probably won't see this show get rebooted in the Celeb Reality universe.
Not this one, but they did reboot The Biggest Loser. I saw a commercial for
it. I saw that too, recently. But I don't think Jillian Michaels is a part of it.
It struck me as, no, it's some white guy. But I was just still surprised. I was like, I thought we had moved past this kind of stuff. But I guess if there's Khloe Kardashian's revenge body, you can reboot The Biggest Loser on, I think it's like on the History Channel or True TV. It's on a strange channel. What? It's like one of those channels that you have to like pay extra for. And you're it's not worth the nine other. Well, you have no idea the weird shit that they have on the History Channel now, Em. It's bizarre programming.
I mean, after you air about 20,000 shows devoted to Hitler, like, you've got to find content elsewhere.
You've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately,
they should name the History Channel War World the way that Westworld named that latest world War World.
Ultimately, I'm still not over that. Yeah, that's another show I'm going to finish up on or catch up with during this time of quarantine. I can't wait.
Don't bother. Just go back to The Sopranos. It's not worth it. I feel like this is truly The Walking Dead all over again, but with a higher budget. I'm like, why the fuck am I watching this? I don't think it's good. But I don't know for sure, so I have to keep watching or else, like, am I dumb? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
To
some extent that might be true, but I have to finish watching this fucking show to figure it out. I'd rather relearn math. Like, this is just so stupid.
It's anyway, unnecessary.
Sorry, you were saying. You were saying.
What was I even saying? God, Margo.
I don't know. I don't know.
I think some of these things were worth revisiting and were a lot of fun to revisit, like Flavor of Love. And then, you know, I watched clips of Surreal Life and I Love New York, but Celeb Fit Club, apart from the Dustin Diamond stuff, really just, there's a reason why I can't find that many YouTube videos of it. It's just not one that people are ever going to really want to revisit.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of some of the older shows, like beyond like a Flavor of Love, like we were talking about, like Rock of Love too, or Charm School, and even Top Model, obviously, there are like key episodes that you could just watch those as like a highlight reel and not have to get into binging. Yeah. And I think that there are some good standout episodes. I'd say like the first three episodes of I Love New York are all pretty standout because you've never seen this before, at least not in 2007. You've never seen this before. So I find the whole first season to be good and the second season to kind of be a little bit forgettable because it loses a little bit of the, oh, wow, what the fuck will she do next kind of sheen. But New York is still an excellent reality TV show personality. She was on Drag Race as a judge and she was great. And I listened to an interview with her on a podcast where she talks about like the end of the New York ride and how it kind of came as a surprise, but she wasn't sure when it was going to happen. So it was like the timing, not necessarily that it ended, but that she's aware that she has started a lot of reality show trends in her time. And she's happy with her legendary status. But I think she was like on Botched. And I do think she is still looking for a man. So I say now's the perfect time to do I Love New York 3.
In this time when we are all confined to our homes, like, what else can we watch?
Put her on Love is Blind.
Oh, my God. Love is New York. Like, that is...
Love is New York. Oh, my God. I love it.
It's like we were talking about, my friends and I the other day on the phone, we're talking about having a show called Love is Quarantined, in which you fall in love with someone while never getting to meet them in person until after everything has been lifted.
Wasn't that an SNL sketch?
It was, in the sense the twist was that people had coronavirus instead of the actual being quarantined.
I am curious to see how those relationships last. I would watch that show. I'd watch anything at this point. Just seriously. Listen to me. I'm planning on watching Cats. I'm not well.
I mean, we'll watch it together, I think, this weekend at one point. Like, we'll probably have to have a conversation about it for sure.
Give me that sweet digital fur. We should also watch Burlesque at some point too. We're obviously getting very far away from what we were talking about. Are there any other wrap-up tidbits from Celeb Reality, VH1, either your Fit Club or anything else?
No, but one last thing about Cats. I just love the campaign where people actually thought there was a butthole cut of the movie and people were...
Wait, are you telling me there isn't?
No, it turns out it's not true.
That's it's really disputed. Upsetting. That was honestly... Yeah. That's too bad because that made me laugh for several days. I needed that boost of serotonin. They come so few and far between now.
The campaign we can all get behind in 2020, #release the butthole cut.
And Well, I have to get to my virtual Vanderpump Rules viewing party. So we're going to go ahead and tell you that, look, you got a ton of time on your hands, much like we have a ton of time on our hands. And,
yep,
you know, one way that you can help us out, you know, you don't need to give us money, although we will always take money. You know, I did lose work. Emily is semi-employed, but we're not asking for money. No, what we're asking, because it's worth more than cash, or maybe, who knows, not as much as toilet paper, but slightly more than cash, are reviews. You know, we just have like 3 reviews, and we've been like sitting at 18 reviews, 5-star reviews for a while. And I just think that like a great time to review our podcast and like give us a little boost is right now. You can go on iTunes and give us a little 5-star and write something nice. And we would deeply appreciate that more than anything, almost as much as we would appreciate you following us on Medium at Old Millennials Pod, where we are putting up some primo content if you want to take a break from refreshing Twitter and yelling into the void. And you can also find us on Instagram at The Old Millennials Pod and on Facebook at the same place. And you can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Marg She Wrote.
And I'm at Emily A. Bijan.
And we have some fun mini episode ideas that we're going to get around to, and plenty of stuff to take your mind off of what's going on. So until you hear from us next time, stay the fuck inside, stay safe, and goodbye.
Bye.